based on historical evidence, did Jesus rise from the dead? I want to introduce you our two speakers for the evening, one speaking against the motion, one speaking for the motion. Firstly, the professor who's speaking against the motion. On my far right, we have Professor Lester Grabe. He graduated from theology in California and earned his first doctorate from Claremont Graduate School. His second doctorate was from here in Hull, at Hull University. And since 1987, he has been head of theology and is currently Dean of Humanities. He also has a personal avid interest in reading detective novels. Always good to put something else in there. Speaking for the motion is Professor John Warwick Montgomery. He graduated in philosophy from Cornell University and earned his first doctorate in history and philosophy from Chicago University, and a second doctorate in theology from the University of Strasbourg, and also has a degree in law. And he is Professor of Law and Humanities at Luton University. His avid interest, as opposed to reading detective novels, is drinking fine wine and eating great food. So, both the gentlemen are originally from North America, and so there'll be a similarity with distinctives in their accents. My name is Phil Wall, and I work for an organisation called the Salvation Army. I won't be handing out any tea this evening. My job tonight is to chair this debate, and let me explain to you the format for the evening. Each of the speakers will be given 25 minutes to make a presentation against and for the motion. Then, after they've done that, there'll be a very brief 2 to 3 minute break. Please stay within the auditorium at that point. Please stay within at that point. It needs to be a 2 to 3 minute debate, 2 to 3 minute break rather than much, much longer. Freudian slip. And then after that, once they have kind of got together their thoughts, we'll ask them to take 12 minutes, 10 to 12 minutes, to give a rebuttal of each other's perspectives so that we can hear their responses to the things that each other has said. And then it'll be your opportunity to join in the proceedings this evening. And we're going to invite you to bring questions from the floor. And the way that we'd like those questions dealt with is this. If you could raise your hand to show that you'd like to ask a question, I'll point to you. If you could stand up at that point and address your question to myself, I will then speak the question back through into the microphone so that everyone can hear that, and then ask whoever it is directed towards to respond appropriately. And then once the question time is finished, there'll be 5 to 7 minutes that each of the speakers has to make a final and concluding statement. Then straight away is to ask you to put your hands together and welcome our first speaker of this evening, Professor Grabe. Would you welcome him again? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. It's nice to see such a large audience. I'm tempted, I think, to forget about the debate and just give my inaugural lecture again. I see a few students from theology, no doubt here, hoping I'll be completely humiliated. I think it's important at the beginning to establish what I am and am not trying to do. A reporter from Hull Fire called me up and asked what would be the implications if the Christians win the debate. Well, as I pointed out, that was a very leading question, because it's assuming that anyone arguing on the other side is automatically not a Christian. I may or may not be a Christian. You don't know. Of course, if I were to declare myself a Christian at this point, there's still people here who would veer that I'm not one because I'm taking this side of the debate. Nevertheless, I may or may not be a Christian. I may or may not believe in the resurrection. But in any case, my personal beliefs are irrelevant to the point at hand. It is not my job to disprove the resurrection of Jesus. You may believe in the resurrection as a matter of faith. If so, I have no quarrel with you. My task is a purely historical one. Is there sufficient evidence for the resurrection that the ordinary historian, applying the normal canons of historical criticism, would say, yes, the resurrection probably happened? My contention is that no, the historical argument used for the resurrection is insufficient to answer the question in the affirmative. Some historians would rule out a priori the idea of such an event as the resurrection, and I think for understandable reasons. However, that is not my approach, certainly not for purposes of this debate. There is nothing particularly mysterious about how a historian goes about evaluating evidence. procedures used are generally familiar to all of us. They are those we use in our everyday lives to filter information. It is just that the historian applies them consciously and systematically. Do we believe everything we hear or read? Of course not, at least most of us don't. How do we decide what to believe and what not to? Well, we consider the source. We consider the intrinsic probability. We measure it against our own experiences and those of others known to us. Let me illustrate with a simple example. There is a somewhat notorious tabloid newspaper, which is even more downmarket than the Sunday Times, and it has become famous for a number of headlines and strange stories, at least I'm told so. One of these was, Freddie Starr ate my hamster. Another was, B-29 found on the moon, complete with photograph. Now, how do you evaluate these stories? The headline about Freddie Starr and the hamster is potentially believable, depending on what is alleged to have happened. If he supposedly gulped down the unfortunate rodent alive and quivering, you would probably not swallow that. On the other hand, if he consumed it barbecued with fava beans and a nice Chianti, you might be willing to accept that, depending on your estimate of the aforementioned Mr. Starr. However, we don't have Mr. Starr's side of the story. Perhaps he would admit the deed, or perhaps he would deny it. Or perhaps he would say, I did dine on the young lady's gerbil, flavored with a touch of piccalilli, but I never touched the hamster. Thus, the story is possible, but there are a number of questions which would need answering before we accepted it. Yet the story about the bomber on the moon we would probably reject, despite the photograph, for a variety of reasons. The difficulties with getting it up there, the fact that no astronomer has reported it, even though it might be seen through a large telescope, or that it had not been seen by the NASA lunar missions. One might argue that in this age of space travel, it might be possible to get an object of that size on the moon, but there would be no reason to do so. So this story would be rejected, along with stories about the sightings of Elvis or being captured by aliens. One factor in our acceptance or rejection of the story is our general view of the source. Now, not everything in that particular newspaper that I mentioned is unbelievable. I understand, for example, that the dimensions of the young ladies featured in its pages are generally credible, if sometimes unusual. But the first thing we must always ask as a historian is the source of the story. What is the nature of the source? What is its bias? What is its interest? What is its point of view? How close is it to the events? Does it contain eyewitness testimony? These are some of the questions we must ask about the accounts of the resurrection. But here we have an additional problem. For unusual events, events which are outside the common experience, we would want stronger evidence than for those which are more ordinary. We would need to feel that other, more prosaic explanations were ruled out. In order to establish an experience such as the resurrection, we would need to eliminate all reasonable alternative explanations. Thus, if a reasonable explanation is possible, that is all that is necessary. We do not have to prove it. The fact that it is possible is sufficient to label the supernatural explanation as unnecessary and unproved. If you go out into the Salisbury Plain, you will see a circle of huge stones which have been standing there for centuries. According to the legend of King Arthur, the magician Merlin brought them there by magic from North Africa. Now, I don't believe this. Why? Well, is it because I've examined the matter exhaustively? Well, no. I haven't tried to investigate whether there might be a, quote, historical core, unquote, behind it. I have not done exhaustive surveys of the geology of North Africa to see whether the stones in Stonehenge might have come from there. The current theory is that it was erected by Neolithic man. But if someone should disprove that thesis, it would not make us embrace the Merlin story, nor would it even cause scholars to give it a serious consideration. In order to accept the supernatural explanation, we would need to eliminate all other more normal explanations, such as that men with ropes, levers, or other mechanical means did the deed. We do not have to prove how or who in order to reject the Merlin story. We only have to show that a conventional explanation is possible. So return to the resurrection. For it, we would like direct eyewitness testimony from a variety of sources with different perspectives and leanings. We would like to hear from the Romans and the Jews, as well as the Christians. And we would like to know that more usual explanations for these reports could be eliminated. Unfortunately, we have no such evidence. Indeed, we have no account of the resurrection at all. No source claims to describe the actual resurrection event. What we have are essentially two claims. One is a collection of testimonies about encounters with the living Jesus after the crucifixion. The other is a set of reports about the tomb being empty. The question is whether either of these is sufficiently well attested to infer the resurrection of Jesus. This brings us to the question of the sources. One might think that we should begin with the Gospels. However, after a century and a half of critical study, there is a general consensus in New Testament scholarship that the Gospels are late compositions, the earliest probably being Mark about the year 70 of the Common Era. Therefore, we shall have to come back to them. The earliest dated reference to the resurrection of Jesus is found in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. By consensus, this is an authentic letter written sometime in the mid-50s, perhaps around 57, some quarter of a century after the crucifixion. In the translation of the Revised Standard Version, 1 Corinthians 15:3-8 reads, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me." Now, it is very important to know what Paul does and does not say. He claims to have information about the experience of others to whom the risen Jesus had appeared. He also claims that he himself has had a similar experience. This also fits with Paul's statement elsewhere in Galatians 1:12, where he states that the gospel he preached came through a revelation of Jesus Christ, and a similar statement in 1 Corinthians 9:1. Paul's own personal statement is very important, and no one can doubt the sincerity with which he makes it. However, a number of questions remain about this account. First of all, we have no evidence that Paul knew Jesus in his earthly life, so how did he make the identification? What convinced him that he was experiencing the risen Jesus? Asking this question makes us realize another important point. No time is given for this seeing of Jesus. Is it possible that Paul had this experience of Jesus after he had already become a Christian? That is, the reason that Paul identified his experience with the risen Jesus may be because he was already a Christian when he had the experience. In other words, Paul's experience could be the result of his own Christian expectations and beliefs. Or to put it more bluntly, the experience could be the product of his own religious fervor, however strongly he felt its truth at the personal level. Now, I can hear some of you saying, but we know that Paul's experience of Jesus was when he was on the road to Damascus to persecute Christians. Well, I'm afraid we know no such thing. Paul never refers to the road to Damascus experience in any of the genuine Pauline epistles. He never refers to such an experience in Romans, Galatians, 1 Corinthians, and so on. The road to Damascus episode occurs in the late book of Acts, written toward the end of the first century. Many New Testament scholars argue that the writer of Acts had no direct knowledge of Paul. Now, it's a point that could be debated at some length, and I don't wish to do that here. What I do wish to emphasize is that it is not a foregone conclusion that Paul's experience of Jesus was the cause of his conversion. It is very possible that it was an event sometime subsequent to his becoming a Christian. We also, in addition to not knowing when Paul had this experience of Jesus, we do not know how he experienced Jesus. He says simply that Jesus appeared to him, othe in Greek, from parao, to see. The word can have a variety of meanings. It can refer to the appearance of human beings in ordinary daily life. It can refer to theophanies or divine visitations. It can refer to appearances in visions or dreams. So how did Jesus appear to Paul? Well, the answer is, we don't know. Was it in a vision? Was it in a dream? A dream is very possible. Dreams were considered an important medium of revealing divine knowledge at that time. There's nothing here or elsewhere in the Pauline epistles to rule that possibility out. Thus, in 1 Corinthians and also in Galatians, we have important eyewitness testimony to a personal experience. But the source of that experience, indeed the time of that experience, is unknown to us. What of all the other witnesses that Paul cites? Unfortunately, they are not direct testimony. They are only in the nature of hearsay reports. We do not know how Paul obtained the information about the appearance of the risen Christ to Peter, the 12, the 500, the apostles, or to James. Did they tell him directly? Did he hear it from a friend who heard it from friends who danced with the Prince of Wales? It has been suggested that this list comes from a liturgical or creedal tradition, which is certainly possible. Though Paul claims to have spent a fortnight with Peter in Jerusalem in Galatians 1:18, and also to have met James in Galatians 1:19. So it's possible that he got the reports about Peter and James directly from them. The problem is that we don't know for sure. It is not likely that the 500, for example, all told him their stories personally. Did he sort of line up one day and they come by, 1, 2, 3, 500, 501? Therefore, Paul's is the only eyewitness testimony to the risen Jesus. The others are secondhand at best, and probably much further removed in the case of some of those named. In the entire New Testament, in fact, in the entirety of first century literature and documentation, this is the only eyewitness testimony to the risen Jesus. Now we come to the gospel accounts. According to the consensus of scholarship, the earliest gospel was Mark, written around 70. The resurrection account of Mark was used by Matthew and Luke independently toward the end of the first century as the basis for their accounts. However, within this basic framework, there is much complicated development. Scholarship of the past several decades has emphasized the originality of the evangelists as creative theologians. So Mark made use of various Christian traditions, which he then adapted and revised and reworked to fit his literary and theological aims. But these traditions which had come down to him had already been developed and shaped by the beliefs and faith of the early church. Thus, the earliest post-crucifixion account already represents a multi-layered piece of theological interpretation and reflection. Mark's account tells us how he understands Jesus in his own life and in the church. The evangelists Matthew and Mark, who followed him, do the same in their own separate and individual and creative ways, as does John. The result, in the opinion of many, is a beautiful and meaningful trio of theological statements. However, from the historian's point of view, even the earliest version of Mark is already far removed from what actually happened. Mark's account is actually quite bare. He makes no reference to the appearance of Jesus to anyone. All he says is that when the women visited the tomb, a young man told them that Jesus was no longer there. At all. I'm only applying the normal canons of historical criticism. I'm only making the same judgments that you would make if it was a story about other figures in another religious tradition. Religious people have often made claims of supernatural experiences throughout history. Such a claim, even if made with all indications of personal conviction, are not normally accepted at face value, at least by the historian. Those who supposedly experienced the risen Jesus were all Christians. Any experiences they had were shaped by their strong beliefs and even caused by their earnest personal faith. This in no way impugns their sincerity, but sincerity does not guarantee truth. Many Muslims believe sincerely that Muhammad made a night journey to Jerusalem and even ascended to heaven. I doubt that any of you believe that, unless you happen to be Muslim. Why not? Well, stories are told about the Buddha as a youth, that he stopped a charging elephant. These stories are told in good faith. Why should you reject them and accept the resurrection of Jesus? Let me give two examples to illustrate the inconsistency with which such religious material has often been evaluated. In Herodotus 4, book 4, sections 13 to 14, is an interesting story. There is also a story related in a poem by Aristeus, son of Caestrobius, and a man of Proconnesus. It is said that this Aristeus was as nobly born as any of the townsmen. He went into a fuller's shop at Proconnesus and there died. The fuller shut his workshop and went away to tell the dead man's kinfolks. And the report of Aristeus' death now being spread about in the city, it was disputed by a man from Cyzicus, who had come from the town of Ortake, and said that he had met Aristeus going towards Cyzicus and had spoken with him. While he vehemently disputed, the kinsfolk of the dead man had come to the fuller's shop with all that was needful for burial. But when the house was opened, there was no Aristeus there, dead or alive. But in the seventh year after that, Aris disappeared at Proconnesus and made that poem with the Greek now called the Arimaspheia, after which he vanished once again. This has many parallels with the resurrection account. A man supposedly dead appears to others at different times, places, and his body is no longer found where it was supposed to be lying. Now let me take a second example. In 1870, at Palmyra, a small town in upper New York State, God the Father and the Son appeared to a young man of about 15 named Joseph Smith. About 3 years later, the angel Moroni appeared to him and told him of a set of golden plates containing divine revelations, including the early history of the North American continent. He found the plates as revealed to him, along with the Urim and Thummim, a device which allowed him to interpret the strange writing on the plates and also to have second sight about other matters. Despite a good deal of opposition, persecution, and attempts to steal the plates, Joseph Smith translated the writings as instructed and published the translation as the Book of Mormon in 1829-30. After that, the plates were taken away by the angel Moroni. Apart from Joseph Smith, three other men had confirmatory visions attesting to the truth of the plates and Smith's translation. And they testified to this fact in written testimonies. In addition, another dozen saw and handled the plates and gave written witness to this fact. A local farmer who assisted Smith in recording the translation and also helped him to fund their publication tested Smith at several points to see whether he was being hoaxed, but was thoroughly convinced of the genuineness of the plates and Smith's sincerity. He even took a transcript of the symbols on the plates and the translation to a linguistics expert and returned assured that they were genuine. In the next decade or so, the Mormon Church grew at an amazing rate, despite a great deal of persecution. In 1844, Joseph Smith and his brother were killed by a mob, though he is said to have predicted his own death. Despite the shock of this martyrdom and continued persecution, the Church of Latter-day Saints grew and thrived and endured to the present. Parallels here are obvious. A church begins as a result of claims to a supernatural revelation. The record of these revelations goes back to an early period. We have Smith's own account and also the account of his mother, Lucy Smith. Most of these claims are, of course, known only from believers. Important confirmatory evidence, such as the golden plates, is no longer available. However, we do have two sets of additional information which we do not have in the case of the resurrection. First, we do have reports from non-believers. For example, contemporary newspaper reports confirmed that at least that there were many rumors circulating with regard to Joseph Smith's claims, and these created a good deal of excitement.
In 5 minutes.
Secondly, we also have hostile reports from townspeople, from in-laws, from the disaffected Mormons. A significant fact about the resurrection is that we have only one side of the story. We lack the reports of those who disputed the resurrection. Now, to summarize my argument, there's no direct testimony to the resurrection itself. No one claims to have witnessed it. All we have is indirect testimony, especially claims to have experienced the risen Jesus. However, these claims are all credited to believing Christians. Much of the testimony is found in late legendary accounts which do not agree among themselves, for example, the Gospels. The only firsthand evidence, I emphasize, the only firsthand evidence of having seen the risen Jesus is in 1 Corinthians 15. This was written in the mid-50s, and no details are given as to how or when Jesus appeared to Paul. We have no evidence to show that the appearances happened before Paul became a Christian, nor to think that his own strong Christian faith was not the main or sole cause of the experience. As for the mode of the experience, it could have been a dream. If someone came to you and claimed to have had a dream in which Jesus appeared, how convinced would you be that it was a genuine supernatural manifestation? If similar evidence was presented about the experience of a Muslim or Jew or Hindu, most Christians would not accept it. So why should the statement of Paul be accepted face value? To the historian, there are too many questions and too few answers. There are too many unknowns, too much uncertainty about the data, and too many alternative explanations. The historian, weighing the historical data, can only conclude that the evidence is insufficient to consider the resurrection a probable event.
Thank you very much. First presentation, and that certainly got our minds and our thought process ticking away. I'd like you to put your hands together, please, and if you would, and welcome Professor John Warwick Montgomery. Thank you.
There's a considerable danger that you might consider a subject like this, as it's being dealt with tonight, as a peculiarly American subject. We have two people with strange accents dealing with the topic, and I think it's particularly important that we see that the whole issue transcends any such considerations. Both Professor Graba and I spent quite a bit of time in California, the land of the fruits and the nuts, but the topic that we're dealing with tonight certainly goes beyond California cultism or general religious phenomena. We're dealing with a subject which Dorothy Sayers described as follows. She said, "It deals with the terrifying assertion that the same God who made the world lived in the world and passed through the grave and the gate of death," unquote. She was also very disturbed by the fact that the clergy are so dull. She said, "Isn't it remarkable that with that kind of a theme, they can manage to be dull?" The significance of this topic, it seems to me, is very well illustrated by a genuine historical experience. This is an event that occurred at the time of the French Revolution. The little-known philosopher La Revelliere was promoting a religion which he called theanthropy, man is godism, as a substitute for Christianity. He did tracts and booklets and a good social program, but the thing didn't take, and he was very discouraged. So he went to fellow philosophers for advice. Among them was Talleyrand. Talleyrand, the skeptic and the humorist. And Talleyrand said to La Revelliere, "It seems to me that Jesus Christ, in order to found his religion, first died and rose again on the third day. You could at least do that much." The point being that if Jesus Christ did rise from the dead, then the implications are simply staggering. What are they? Well, for one thing, Christianity then is a religion which is technically, analytically, philosophically meaningful because it is, at least in principle, disconfirmable. I'm sure you're aware that in contemporary analytical philosophy, great stress is placed upon the matter of disconfirmability. If a position cannot be discounted no matter what the evidence is, then the position is technically meaningless. The passage that Professor Graba read to you from 1 Corinthians goes on and makes this statement: if Christ is not risen from the dead, then we, Christians, are of all people most miserable. We've been deceiving other people, and we are deceiving ourselves. The point is that if Christ did not rise again from the dead, then the Christian church ought to close up shop. If there are any bishops still around, like the former Bishop of Durham, they should be doing something else. They should be doing some constructive social work, postman, fireman, whatever. Also, competing religious claims can be dealt with quite effectively if the resurrection of Jesus Christ did in fact occur. Then there becomes a verifying event by which one can test competing religious claims. And this is terribly important because all religions do not say the same thing, and some of them are highly dangerous. The Waco incident, years before that, the incident in British Guiana, the cult in Switzerland just a couple of years ago, these are examples of religious positions that are very, very dangerous. Professor Graba mentioned a couple of other religious positions. I will get to those in a bit. Then, if the resurrection occurred, the position of Jesus Christ is established, and it becomes possible to make transcendental assertions about values. One can arrive at a value system which isn't based upon changing human opinion. One of my fields is the field of human rights, and one of the most frustrating things in the human rights field, of course, is the fact that what one person considers a human right, someone else doesn't. What's needed is a foundation which is so solid that it will not alter with changing social patterns. If Jesus rose from the dead and verified his claim to be God Almighty come to earth, then we end up with a transcendental set of values which can stand even when social trends change. And finally, of course, the matter of getting right with the universe becomes feasible. People talk about getting right with the universe. They talk about salvation or whatever term they want to use for it in other religions. But the fact of the matter is that this requires some kind of eternal foundation as well. The resurrection would provide this if it were, in fact, true. Perhaps I can say just a word autobiographically, and I'll also give you some interesting information on Professor Graeber, because he didn't tell you a great deal about himself. We are really a match set, because when I went to university, I went as a garden variety 20th century pagan. And at university, majoring in philosophy and classics in Greek and Latin studies, I got into an examination of the New Testament documents. These documents were exactly what convinced me that Jesus had risen from the dead, and as a result of this, I was dragged kicking and screaming into the kingdom, though it was hardly what I had expected. In those days, I corresponded with C.S. Lewis of Shadowlands fame, and I was very much influenced by some of the things that he had to say. I was particularly interested in his autobiography, in which he described a similar experience when he was an undergraduate at Oxford. He was in a seminar, and they were discussing Fraser's dying god and laughing about this myth. And Lewis said to himself, but just suppose it did happen. Suppose the dying god was a historical reality. It would absolutely change everything. Professor Graeber had a kind of reverse religious experience. He describes this in a Festschrift article published here. He points out that he grew up in American fundamentalism and then was converted away from it as a result of taking graduate work at an independent quasi-Methodist institution in California. The only reason that I mention this is that Professor Graeber, in that same article, makes perfectly plain that what I'm doing here tonight is not scholarship. He excludes from the realm of scholarship people like myself. He says that those who have made a commitment in an area like this cannot be objective about their studies in that same realm, and that therefore the fundamentalist, and he uses this term for people such as myself, the fundamentalist is simply a person who has already made a decision and conforms all of the evidence to the prior decision that he makes. Now, I would like to point out that in the first place, if one comes to a commitment on the basis of evidence, one certainly has the right subsequently to present that evidence. That is what goes on all the time in scholarship. That doesn't remove in any way from objectivity. The historic meaning of the term professor is one who professes something. He doesn't profess it dogmatically, he professes it on the basis of evidence. And secondly, I'm also a barrister, and in advocacy, you go in behalf of your client and you present the best evidence you possibly can, and the other side does the same thing. And this evidence is offered to a neutral trier of fact, a jury, and they are the ones who can come to the conclusion that they feel is appropriate. Thus, the fact that one has a commitment, that one is an advocate or a professor, in no way reduces the scholarly value of what one does. Well, let's come to the case for the resurrection. First of all, let's say something about methodology. Let's get the methodology clear here, and then we'll go into the particulars. Can we even ask this question? as to whether the resurrection is historical. Professor Graba says to us, if an event is out of our ordinary experience, then of course it requires an incredible amount of evidence in order to support it. The more uncommon the event, the more evidence is necessary for it. This argument, of course, goes back to David Hume, the Scottish philosopher David Hume in the 18th century. Hume said that there is a uniform experience against miracles. And since there's a uniform experience, if anyone comes along and says, I saw a miracle, you can know ahead of time that the person can't be correct in what he says. Of course, Hume's approach here was based on an 18th century view of natural law. Hume thought that the laws of the universe were so well known that we can simply rule out unique events. Today, we're living in an Einsteinian open universe in which no one has the presumption to say that certain events are not possible. The only way you can discover whether an event occurs is to go out and check the evidence for it. Now, how much evidence is necessary to demonstrate historically a resurrection? The trouble is that we get hung up on the word resurrection, the concept of resurrection. We say, well, goodness, we haven't seen anything like that. Everybody who's died in our experience has stayed dead, and therefore there would have to be an infinite amount of evidence in behalf of it. Fiddlesticks. You could only say there has to be an infinite amount of evidence if you know cosmically, ahead of time, a priori, that resurrections don't occur. But there's no way in the world you can know this. You can't check under every rock in the universe to make sure a resurrection isn't going on there. And you can't do it historically, and you can't do it in the future. Thomas Sherlock, who was master of the Temple Church in the 18th century, dealt with this in a work entitled The Trial of the Witnesses to the Resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Sherlock said, how much evidence would it take? Suppose someone came and told you that a person had risen from the dead. Would you say in principle it was impossible to determine this? Of course you wouldn't, because you know what such a thing would involve. It involves, if it occurred, a person being alive at point A, dead at point B, and alive again at point C. Now, we all know what being dead involves, and we all know what being alive involves. This is why when we go into a funeral parlor, we can distinguish the corpse from the mortician. If, for example, you go up to a graying gentleman sitting there in the funeral home, and you offer him some fish to eat, and he eats it, you can be reasonably sure it's not the corpse, but rather the mortician. In order to determine whether resurrection occurred, you have to know, A, that the given individual is dead. Then, subsequently, you have to have sufficient evidence that the individual is alive again. Now, it's very interesting that in the case of the gospel accounts, we have most of the material having to do with those very events in Jesus' life. The last week of Jesus' life, roughly one quarter to one half of the gospel accounts consist of material having to do with those events. And the events are gone into in staggering detail. The crucifixion and exactly what it involved, and then the post-resurrection events over a period of some 40 days, and these given in tremendous detail. Did Jesus die? Answer, he certainly did. Did he die on the cross? Yes. There's an article in the American Medical Association in 1986 where three medical specialists go to work on the gospel accounts to see if what occurred there, as described there, in terms of the crucifixion, meant that Jesus indeed died. This is an article of some 20, 25 pages. It goes into tremendous detail. For example, the sword being put into his side, the blood and water coming out, the cardiac sac around the heart being punctured, blood, lymph, and so forth. Subsequent to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, we have in these accounts the detailed narratives of encounters with him. And these are not the kind of vague Fatima vision, sung whirling around stories that you get in some religious settings. Instead, you have the greatest degree of specificity. Thus, at the end of the Gospel of Luke, we have the disciples seeing Jesus coming along the shore, subsequent to his crucifixion. And they think they're seeing a ghost. This wouldn't be a very smart thing to put in, really, if you were trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. They thought they were seeing a ghost. And he said, "Do you have anything here to eat?" And they gave him some fish, and he ate the fish with them. I did a book on the occult some years ago, Research in the Black Forest. I never came across a fish-eating ghost. Not one. Huh? For some reason, ghosts don't care for fish. Probably it's the absence of tummy that has to do with this. And we have the famous Doubting Thomas incident, where Thomas will not believe what the other disciples tell him about the resurrection, and finally Jesus comes, and Jesus allows him physical contact in order to demonstrate this. The nail prints in his hands, the wound in his side. Now, this kind of evidence means that we can most definitely handle this matter from a historical standpoint. It doesn't, of course, mean that anyone will necessarily believe it personally, because belief, personal belief, involves commitment. There are really two stages in belief. The first is coming to see where the evidence lies, and the second is to recognize the implications of that for oneself personally. And there may be any number of reasons why individuals will not want this to be the case. Of course, if the resurrection did occur, then Jesus is the person he claimed to be. Who did he claim to be? He claimed to be no less than God come to earth. One of the accounts has one of the disciples saying, "Show us the Father." And Jesus says, "Have I been so long with you and you have not known me? He who has seen me has seen the Father." These are Orthodox Jews talking. There aren't multiple gods. There's only one. And Jesus says, "You're seeing him right before you." And of course it means that if the resurrection occurred and Jesus is God, then he's forgotten more about salvation than you and I will ever know. That is to say, when he says that the way to fulfillment and the way to cosmic meaning is in personal relationship with him, that's exactly what is the case. Of course, if you want to run your own life, then that is very disturbing, because he wants to run it for you, and he can do it better than you, but of course, whether you believe that is another matter. Well, how do we investigate this sort of thing? If it's possible to investigate it, how do we do it? Professor Graeber is quite correct. We use historical method, just like we would for any other event. Historical method involves determining, in this case, whether the documentary records are sound concerning Jesus, and whether the testimony that they contain is credible. It involves documents and testimony. Now, I'm going to put on my historian's hat for the documents, and then I'm going to put on my lawyer's hat for the witnesses. On the documents, Chauncey Saunders, who is a military historian and therefore not especially biased theologically, Chauncey Saunders says that if you are going to establish the value of a document, you've got to do it by determining first its transmission, second, whether it is internally sound, and second, whether there are external witnesses or external evidence to back up what the document says about itself. All right? Has the text of the New Testament come to us substantially as it was originally written? That is a technical question, and the area of textual criticism deals with it. I can only give you the consistent judgment of people who work in this area. I use Sir Frederick Kenyon, who was principal librarian of the British Museum, as an example. He says, and he said this years before some of the most recent papyrus discoveries, he said, "The manuscripts that we have for the New Testament are the best attested manuscripts of the classical world." That is, our problems come from too many good copies rather than too few. and therefore it is possible to work back through these copies so that we can be substantially sure that what we have today is the material as it was originally written. What do these documents say internally? They claim to be eyewitness documents. For example, in one of the letters of Peter, Peter says, after saying that he was with Jesus on the mountain of Transfiguration, he says, "We have not followed cunningly devised fables," the Greek there is mutheloi, myths, "when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." And John talks again and again as one who actually had contact with the person that he is describing. Luke, at the beginning of his gospel, in a short paragraph that's been compared to Thucydides or Herodotus, to a classical historian, says that he has carefully sifted the source material so as to give precisely what actually happened. Luke doesn't claim to have seen these events himself, but he says he's gone through the material to make sure that what he presents is accurate.
In 5 minutes, please.
Thank you. And in the external area, we have such evidences as these. The death of Paul is clearly early in the 60s. Early in the 60s, perhaps at the time of the Neronian persecution. But in any case, certainly no earlier than 60, no later than 64. You can check this out with the Jewett's Chronology of Paul's Life, which is the most recent one on the subject. Now, as Harnack pointed out, early in the century, if the book of Acts was written that early, and Luke is the first part of Acts written earlier, and Luke used sources, and it is universally agreed that one of these sources was Mark, then all of that material is pushing back right on to the year 30, approximately the time when Jesus was crucified. All of that stuff comes within a generation. Professor Graeba rather arrogantly states in his work on Judaism from Cyrus to Hadrian that all of this stuff comes at the very end of the first century. He gives a date of about 90. He will not agree that anything is earlier than 70. It's painfully obvious that's because he doesn't believe that these books are capable of predicting the fall of Jerusalem. They talk about something that obviously is the fall of Jerusalem. They claim to be predicting it. Professor Graeba says, oh no, they can't do that. So the stuff is pushed late. But the fact of the matter is that in terms of the death of Paul and the fact that the book of Acts focuses on it, that material has got to be early. And we have collaborating material from Polycarp, from Papias, and even Professor Graeba says that Eusebius, who provides the Papias material, is indeed a reliable historian. All right, the witnesses, those who speak in these documents. It's interesting the number of lawyers who have been convinced of this testimony. For example, Professor Graeba cites A.N. Sherwin White, who is a legal historian. Sherwin White says, I can't understand what the fuss is about. If we take the best-known contemporary of Jesus, Tiberius Caesar, everything we know about him comes from four records, and these four are infinitely less valuable as testimony than the four Gospels. What are the theologians screaming about? I knew Lord Diplock very well. Lord Diplock, who died just a few years ago, once at Inner Temple, just after Trevor Roper had authenticated the Hitler diaries, Diplock said, ha ha, he said, all his career, Trevor Roper's been saying the gospel accounts aren't worth anything. Trevor Roper couldn't identify a forgery if it came up and kissed him. Lord Hailsham, in his autobiography, points out that a lawyer knows what a forgery is. You can't fool all of the people all the time. You can't create a message in a document as if it were early when it actually is late without this coming out. And the gospel records have stood up in that situation. And as to the hostile witnesses, F.F. Bruce, a late professor at the University of Manchester, he was not a clergyman at all. F.F. Bruce points out that since these materials were circulating as early as the first generation, the hostile witnesses to the life of Jesus, principally Jewish religious leaders, would certainly have refuted all of this if they had been able to. They had the means, the motive, and the opportunity to do so. The very fact that they were unable to do this is one of the strongest arguments for the veracity of the accounts. All right, just one final word about the resurrection per se. Professor Graba says we have to eliminate other explanations. This has already been done, incidentally, by Frank Morrison, a legally trained writer, in his work, Who Moved the Stone? Says Morrison, if you don't go along with the resurrection of Jesus Christ, you've got to explain the missing body. What happened to it? There were only three groups of people who would have had any reason to take that body. The Romans, the Jewish religious leaders, and the disciples. Obviously, the Romans aren't going to do it. It's against their interests. They're collecting taxes. They want things quiet. They don't want resurrections going on. The Jewish religious leaders, they were the last people to take the body. In fact, they asked to have a guard put on the tomb so a rumor wouldn't even start that Jesus had risen again from the dead, because he was contradicting the position they took. And, says Morrison, if the disciples had taken the body, then you would have the anomalous situation that they knew he hadn't risen, yet they go out and they die for it. Now, of course, people have died for a lot of screwball things across the centuries. No doubt about that. But it's one thing to die for something you believe is true and it isn't. And it's a totally different thing to die for something you know absolutely isn't true. They would not have stolen the body. And if you've eliminated all of those instances, what are you left with? You're left with what the primary accounts tell us, that he rose again from the dead. And he says, if I...
Did you hear me? Thank you. Well, there's certainly been much to stimulate our thinking thus far. And we thank both Professor Graby and Professor Montgomery for their contributions to our evening's debate. What's going to happen now is they're going to have their opportunity for 12 minutes to rebut, as regards to respond, if you like, to the presentation of the other speaker. And then after that time, we're going to open up for questions. For those of you who've arrived late, and when we go to questions, if you would raise your hand, I'll point to you. If you could then stand and address the question to myself, I will then repeat the question for the sake of the recording and for the rest of the audience, and then address it to one of the two speakers who, at that point, gentlemen, please, I've neglected to say, you could be standing by the microphones, please. That would be very, very helpful. So please, would you welcome for his rebuttal, Professor Graby. Thank you very much indeed.
Montgomery asked whether we can handle the question historically. It wasn't necessary to convince me. I'd already conceded that point. In fact, I'd argued that point. So that's not a quarrel between us. However, I think maybe I was slightly misrepresented when I about my statement that it requires more evidence for an unusual experience. The statement was made about requiring an infinite amount of evidence. I didn't use that phrase. I actually laid down fairly specifically the types of evidence we would like to see, such as eyewitness accounts from various people who were not just Christians. But the point is that Professor Montgomery here is confining his remarks to the Christian context. The other examples I gave, I think he would be just as skeptical as I am. For instance, about the Merlin story and Stonehenge. We have to be careful about debating this as if this is within a confined circle of Christians. We have to keep in mind that there are other religious traditions that also make claims equally weighty to that of Christianity, and people who adhere to them just as fervently. And therefore, the fact that Christianity makes a claim about a particular individual who lived in the first century doesn't make it unique. I'll bypass some points that I don't think are strictly relevant. I'll just make one point about my rejection of fundamentalism. I do reject fundamentalism, which I lay out, frankly, in an article that was referred to. I was not referring to that a person who is a Christian or who has beliefs can't be objective. I was referring to a specific view of the text of the Bible. Fundamentalism is usually defined as seeing the text as being inherent in the autographs. There's no other text in the world that people who make that statement would make it for, except for the New Testament and the Old Testament. Yes, I do reject that view. I think all texts have to be viewed on their merits, and yes, I object to someone who approaches anything in the biblical text already ruling out various possibilities. I would approach the Old and New Testaments as I would any other ancient literature, and would evaluate them as historical sources the way I would evaluate any other literature. I am not making a distinction here, and I think this is perhaps the difference between Professor Montgomery and myself. I think he is making a distinction. He is treating the New Testament as different from any other documents. Now, we have to evaluate all documents by their characteristics. I don't mean that all documentation is the same. In fact, part of my argument is that the Gospels are not the same documentation as 1 Corinthians, which does represent a writing by an individual who, and it's accepted that this is his writing, it is substantially what he said, and he's describing a personal experience. So I approach the New Testament as I would any other source. I take account of what I think are the characteristics that I can find there. I take account of New Testament scholarship. The comment was made that Luke sifted the source material to give what is accurate. A lot of ancient historians make that same claim. Josephus makes that claim as well. And those of you who do my Judeo-Christian Foundations course will know that I spend a bit of time on showing Josephus is not quite up to that mark. This doesn't mean I reject Josephus. It means I treat him critically. I ask questions. I look at his particular biases. I look at his particular source in any particular case. At times, I think Josephus is quite a reliable historian. At other times, I think he is very unreliable. But in every case, I treat it critically. I accepted that the claim that Jesus had risen from the dead and had appeared goes back to an early period. I do not and did not make the statement that it's found only in the late first century. If we come to Paul, who's writing in the mid-50s, as I say, he makes that claim. He could be referring to an experience perhaps in the 30s. So I don't say that we're not close to the time when some of these things happened. In my dating of New Testament sources, I'm simply following the conventions of New Testament scholarship. And obviously, in the few statements I made on the subject, I compressed an enormous amount that goes on in scholarship. Obviously, many of these points are capable of being debated. But where there is a consensus, and there is still a strong consensus that Mark is the earliest gospel written around 70, and where there's a strong consensus, you have to take it seriously. That doesn't mean that one shouldn't be willing to go against it if one has good, strong evidence. And that's what historians should do. References were made to Polycarp, Polycrates. These are not early Christians who have separate accounts from the Gospels. These are second century writers. Reference was made to Eusebius, who was said to be, the statement was claimed that I made the statement that he was a reliable historian. I don't remember the specific context, but the point is that when Eusebius quotes from other sources, it's usually found that he quotes accurately. In some cases, yes, I think he's probably an accurate historian, a reliable historian. In other cases, I don't think he probably is. He's writing in the in the early 4th century, and I don't think he always knows what was happening in the 1st century. In fact, in many cases, I would think he doesn't. The point is that I evaluate Eusebius as I would any other historian on the merits of the particular case. Now, the Gospels themselves are indeed very specific about the resurrection and about seeing Jesus and so on. There are novels that are very specific about different things. I could write a novel set here in Hull in 1995, and I could be very specific and tell you a lot of things that were true about Hull and people and so on. That doesn't make it truth. It doesn't make it a reliable historical account. It might for certain events, it might for certain bits of data, but the entire story I make up could be completely fiction. The fact that people were capable of writing detailed graphic stories about the appearance of Jesus to them, to me, proves nothing. It may just prove vivid imagination. It may prove just good literary characteristics. Or this by itself proves nothing. Certainly, if you take a doubting Thomas and tell a story about a doubting Thomas, it seems to me you're trying to prove something that someone has doubted. So what better than to give a story about a doubting Thomas? That by itself doesn't prove anything. The text of the New Testament, is it reliable? I think it's generally accepted that on the whole it is. There are a few passages where it may make some difference, but I can make the same claim about the Book of Mormon. Is it reliable? Does it go back? Can it be shown to go back early? It's very well documented. That by itself proves nothing. Sherwin White is one Roman historian who has given one opinion. There are other Roman historians who will give another opinion. I would consider myself a Roman historian, at least for Judaism in the Roman period. I would give another opinion about Acts. In that, I would be following partly my own investigations and partly the consensus of scholarship. There are other Roman historians I could quote who would not evaluate the Gospels or Acts in the same way that Sherwin White has. Simply quoting him proves one opinion of someone who is respected but is also not above criticism. And certainly one of his more recent books was given quite devastating reviews, so he's not infallible. F.F. Bruce, who himself was known to be quite conservative, though often he's quoted by a fundamentalist, but I have been told he was not. I didn't know him well enough before his death to have discussed that with him, but